Thanks a lot for inviting on giving this talk. And what I'm going to present, it would not have been possible without the contribution also of the people listed here in terms of stellar parameters exactly. Interpreting those a bit in a bigger galactic context, and for the sake of this conference also, of course, from the astroseismic point of view. And also thanks for the title, classical. Sounds very nice. Could be like boring stellar parameters, but thanks for being kind to me. And so what I mean by stellar properties, well, it's going to be effective temperature, metallicity, to some extent also surface gravity. And the talk is going to be like an uneven balance among those. And of course, from a theoretical point of view, you're interested in other quantities and also why not ages. And we'll see that combining the classical view with astroseismology, you might gauge into some of those. And what I mean by classical, well, it's going to be spectroscopy. And well, it's just spectra. There's lots of information there, but there's also model dependence there. Or can be either photometry, which is basically a convolution of your spectra to the filter transmission function. And so the information in that way is more compact, in a way is more degenerate, but is also less model dependent, and we'll see to which extent. And those classical approaches has been historically used for a number of purposes. For the sake of this talk, basically, it's going to be like stellar population and stellar modeling, a bit of galactic chemical evolution, and the wedding of those two fields, which is ensemble astroseismology. And so let's start with first classic, and it's going to be measure. So which measure is going to be photometry. And so this is just a plot showing roughly a few 10,000 stars from a recent revision of the Geneva-Copenhagen survey that we did. And it's mostly FG K-type stars, which is also the sort of spectral type I'm going to cover in this talk. And you simply see that just a basic, very simple idea, color plot. And you have your stars, you compare with synthetic colors at different different metallicities and different temperatures, and you see that you have a splitting. Certain baseline colors are more sensitive to metallicities, other to effective temperature, and so that's basically the path that we're gonna follow in the talk. So everybody knows what the effective temperature is. It's defined at a given optical depth, defined in the surface of the star, and the way to probe that is via interferometry, which is the fundamental way of measuring diameter. And it can be precise, it can be accurate, so both of them, even in Europe. And it's limited to pretty much nearby stars by definition, because you want stars big enough that you can measure the diameter. And there is one caveat, which is what you measure is the uniform disk, but what you need to define effective temperature then, through the basic relation, is the limb darkened disk. And very often it's neglected, but I just wanted to make the point that this correction is not model independent. There is a bit of model dependence, and this has been recently addressed by a paper by Andrea Chevassa, that you see that 3D models, for example, predict less center to limb variation compared to standard parametrization, which are often used for correcting from uniform disk to limb darkness. And that affects the resulting angular diameters, and so the resulting effective temperature. And then, what is called semi-direct method is the infrared flux method. I'm going to talk more extensively in the coming slides. It's precise. The accuracy, well, was a limitation because it depends on the absolute calibration. And hopefully that has now been sorted out. And I'll show you how. It's nearly model independent, which is a plus. It can be applied to any stars, for example, as long as you have photometry. So it's ideal for the Kepler field. But being photometric, of course, depends upon reddening. And then finally, well, indirect technique, which are basically based on spectra, can be precise, can be applied on any stars as long as there is spectra, but there is much higher model dependency, even though you don't have to bother, for example, with reddening. And as I told you, we're going to focus on the infrared flux method. So the original idea was introduced by Blackwell and collaborators, and a few people, including myself, have been working on that over the years. And the basic idea is really straightforward. So on the left-hand side, you have the fluxes that you observe on the Earth, so the volumetric stellar flux that as you observe on the Earth, and the infrared flux. And on the right-hand side, you have the same quantities defined on a surface element of the stars. So you have the definition of effective temperature and the infrared flux. And the nice part of working in the infrared is that basically you're working in the Planck tail, so there is not really much model dependence, even if it comes from model. And actually, in the very first works on the topic, people were just using blackbody tails. And so if you have multiband photometry, you can use that multiband photometry to recover your bolometric flux. And the more bands you have, the better it is, because the less you're relying on bolometric corrections. And then you can just solve this in terms of effective temperature. And usually, you iterate a bit your technique for estimating the missing flux. And the de facto choice nowadays for the infrared is basically two mass. So far, so good. And as I told you, the basic idea is to convert fluxes, magnitude, into fluxes. And if you don't do that properly, that's what happens. So, and if you want to put this sketch like in a formula, basically, you have that your magnitude of the star you're observing is translated into flux, but that depends on the standard star defining the photometric system, or the ensemble of stars defining the photometric system. And if that is not done properly, or there are some uncertainties, you know, typical uncertainties on the zero point of the standard stars and on the flux of the standard stars are of this order, and that translates in these typical uncertainties. So that's why, for example, in literatures, different implementation of the same technique gave different results because of this uncertainty. Fortunately, things are getting better now because there has been improved HST absolute fluxes, as well as an independent approach via solar twinks, so stars which look identical to the sun, and then we use those to anchor the zero point of the temperature scale, requiring that they have the solar temperature. And so we think, we did a lot of work in pinning those uncertainties down, and we think we now have reached quite good confidence on the zero point of the temperature scale. And of course, ideally, you would like to apply your infrared flux method to any stars you have, but you need the infrared photometry and multiband photometry for the bolometric flux. So if that is not available, what you can do is to resort on color calibration, where different colors have different sensitivity to metallicity, different sensitivity to reddening, and so you can use those. And one point that you have to keep in mind is that, of course, you're using sort of, you know, fitting polynomial functions. And like in certain ends, like where you have fewer stars, of course, those calibration can go a bit unleashed. So of course, if it's possible, it's always better to apply the direct technique. But when it's not, then you can resort on this sort of calibrations. And recently, I want to point out that it just came out a very nice paper a couple of days ago. So it was a bit hectic reading, but it was pleasant. And on the color calibration for the Kepler field. So, as I said, in the infrared flux method, it doesn't depend very much on models, which means that if you sort of more or less know the metallicity of your star and the log G, then what you do is just you converge in temperature. And the main uncertainty in the past was about the zero point of the flux scale, which has now been pinned down. And so what is left is the bolometric flux, which, as I told you, it comes from broadband, multiband, broadband colors. So they're not very sensitive to stellar parameters, which in this case is a pro. And the model dependence here, which again is pretty well behaving in that region. So one can account for the error budget by taking into account, you know, the zero point uncertainties, running Monte Carlo for the photometric errors. And for example, you see that even quite substantial changes in log G and metallicity affect the resulting temperature by sort of not that much. One of the issues is then reddening. I'm going to return on that in a few slides. At the moment, the code for the infrared flux method, as we have it, works in the Johnson-Causin and JHK two-mass system. We are converting this into the U-grids and applying that to the native Sloan data, as well as to the Kepler input catalog Sloan data. And the first step that you do is to ensure that your Sloan system is on the same scale as the Johnson-Causin system in terms of temperatures. And so you do that via field stars that have both Johnson-Causin and U-grids Sloan photometry, as well as stellar clusters. And one nice thing about stellar cluster, for example, in this case, M67, you just take, you know, like typical distance modulus values, and you directly work in physical quantities, effective temperature, and bolometric luminosity. And you see that there is a very nice agreement. There is not adjustment, just taking, you know, typical values. And you see that you reproduce very well the main features. So that gives also some confidence that the way you recover the bolometric flux is consistent with the way you recover the effective temperatures. And we are applying this to SEGWE. SEGWE is the Sloan extension for galactic understanding and exploration. It's about several hundred thousands of stars having low resolution spectra, and there is a pipeline deriving parameter for those stars. And mostly, SEGWE is targeting like high galactic latitude areas, so it's not very much affected by reddening. Here, for comparison, though, is the typical location of Kepler stars. And we'll see that reddening might be a bit more of an issue. But anyway, bottom line is that there is a validation between the Sloan temperatures derived through the standard Sloan pipeline and those that are derived via infrared flux method over a wide range of effective temperatures and metallicities. And so one can do the same thing for stars having Keck Huygens photometry from the Kepler input catalog. And has been the Kepler input catalog, I pretty much assume everybody knows what it is here. So, but anyway, provides a lot of information about Kepler stars in terms of broadband photometry, estimate of effective temperature, metallicity, surface gravity, reddening, and much, much more. And he has also been pointed out in the recent paper by Pinsonneau that there are some 0-point offsets, though, between the native Sloan Huygens photometry and that available into Keck. So we pretty much recover the same sort of offsets. And those have to be corrected before you can apply your infrared flux method or your color calibration. So that is something that is being done. And here is the comparison in terms of effective temperature that were derived from this work for Silva Aguirre. The purpose of the work was to build one solar mass evolutionary track in a model-independent way. And of course, for doing that, you use scaling relation and you need input effective temperature. So this is the one that we derived for those stars. And this is the difference with respect to the Kepler input catalog. So you see like a substantial offset of the order of a couple hundreds of Kelvin, and it starts drifting even higher. And basically, these same sort of trends were already found in spectroscopic measurements. Now the scale is reversed and reversed again. And recently as well, from the paper by Pinsonneau, again, same axis but reversed definition. And again, you see that the bottom line is that the temperatures available in the Kepler input catalogs are usually too cool by a couple hundreds of Kelvin or possibly even more, depending also on the exact temperature range you are focusing. And as I told you before, via this scaling relation, then of course you can also probe like mass and radii, and so surface gravity values, and compare those with those which are provided in the Kepler input catalog. But a useful byproduct of this is that, as I told you, what you do, you recover the bolometric flux, you recover the effective temperature, and so automatically you also have the angular diameters of your star. And actually, you use the angular diameters of stars with interferometric measurements to check the 0-point of your TF scale to be consistent also with interferometry. And that's what we did. But what I find interesting is that you get the radii and you get the angular diameter. So of course it's simple algebra. You just get the distances of your stars. And well, while waiting for Gaia, we will be able, you know, like with Gaia eventually, to know the distances and therefore, in a way, to check if the radii or the angular diameters we derive in are consistent with the fundamental astrometric measurements. But while waiting for that, I think with distances, we'll have some interesting insights on the thing you can do in the Kepler field, and I'm going to show you those in a while. But so let's move with the second classic. It's everything is really that good. Well,
Nothing that I'm wired.
Okay, well, maybe it's good for you because then I'm over. But so I didn't talk about extinction. I'm going to just go quickly through it. But as I told you, these are photometric measurements, and so they're affected by extinction. And this is just an example of a typical RGB star for a relatively high value of extinction. And that's, of course, affect your photometry. And in our case, it affects the infrared flux. If you just focus on that, these are the systematic that you get if you don't correct for extinction. But it affects more broadly in the sense that, you know, it enters in bolometric and infrared flux. and the systematic that enter in this case are quite substantial again. Bottom line is that for normal nearby field stars, typical values of or uncertainties of reddening could be that low. And in this case, then the effect on effective temperature is some few tens of Kelvin. But this is sort of optimistic accuracy, which usually you don't get it. And here is a comparison between a Schlegel map for the Kepler field. And of course, it's like integrated throughout the line of sight. And it has a certain resolution, which is a few arc minutes. So it's not on a star-by-star basis. And here is the same reddening map from the Kepler input catalog. And because this is integrated throughout the line of sight, you would expect, you know, like it's an overestimate. It's like an upper limit. But you see that when you do the difference, sometimes stars in Kick, they do have like overestimated reddening compared to the Schlegel map. So how do we cope with that? Intermediate band photometry can help us on that through the Strömgren system. So you have different indexes which are sensitive, say, to the effective temperature, the B minus Y index, or the H beta, which is also sensitive to the effective temperature. But the way it's constructed is two filters on top of each other at the same effective wavelength, which doesn't change with reddening. So what historically has been done is to use this to build up intrinsic color calibration, where basically the H beta result has to give you the same result as the B minus Y. And so from that, you factor out reddening on a star-by-star basis. Strömgren photometry is also useful for metallicities. We did that in the revision of the Geneva-Copenhagen survey. And here's the comparison between the photometric and the spectroscopic measurements for 1,500 stars. And here's an independent comparison, which was done by Sousa recently using HARPS, high-resolution spectra. And again, there is really excellent agreement between the photometric and the spectroscopic in terms of zero point and in terms of scatter, which is really exciting. And, well, can you get alpha? If you go to cooler temperatures, you start to form molecules, and there is a limited sensitivity on alpha, so it's really not that high. Bottom line is that you might get something, and we call like this to stress that it's not really.
We have so many alphas in this field. So maybe this
oh, is right. Yep. Yeah, sure. Apologies for that. Yes. In this case, alpha elements basically is the elements of magnesium, silicium, titanium, and calcium respect to the iron abundance. And that is important, for example, when you study the early galaxy, because, of course, it's the main producer. In the early galaxy is type 2 supernova, and then type 1a kicks in, and they produce the iron. So in a very short and schematic explanation. And so that was about the Strömgren photometry, which is a narrow or intermediate band. Can broadband provide us some proxy metallicities? Well, historically, yes. If you think the very first works were done on the UV excess, but as far as it concerned the U-grid system, it wasn't engineered for stellar astrophysics. It's good for, say, for example, for recovering bolometric fluxes because you have lots of flux, but it's not optimal for metallicities nor for gravities. And there is a very nice paper by Anna Dottir where it shows the comparison between the Strömgren measurements and those from the Ivesich calibration on the Sloan system. And you see that there are indeed worrisome trends. And similarly, you can look up for gravities. And so, thanks. So the last 3 minutes is for Great Expectation, the last classic of the talk. So what I think is very exciting for the future is really bridging different fields, like stellar and galactic astrophysics. In fact, I told you that from broadband photometry, we can get effective temperature, bolometric luminosities, angular diameters. From intermediate band photometry, we can get metallicities, reddening on a star-by-star basis, and to some extent, log-G. And astroseismology, of course, it provides much more than that. I know it's an exciting short list, but for the sake of this talk. Eventually, if there's going to be also apogee measurements for the Kepler field, that's going to provide radial velocities. And so each of these provides you a bit of information about something. From the metallicity measurements, you can get the metallicity distribution function. And things from astroseismology, you can get very accurate differential ages. You're going to gauge on the age metallicity relation. And since you get distances by comparing radii and angular diameters, you know, you can get metallicity gradients with time, And once you know the distances, you know the radial velocities, and you also get orbits for those stars. So this is just showing what has been possible to do until now for, say, a few tens of thousands of stars in the solar neighborhoods, 40 parsec roughly, and where you have indeed kinematic distances, broadband photometry, Strombolian colors. And so this is just a few selected results. This is the metallicity distribution function chopping into different ages. And you see young stars. By young, I mean about a giga year. They peak around the solar value. So you can ask yourself, you know, how typical is the sun? And then historically, the metallicity distribution function has been used to put constraints on the gas infall rate on the disk. And you see that as time goes on, you build up different wings of that. And it's very hot topic at the moment to constrain, for example, stellar radial migration in the disk, where stars, you know, from different locations in the galaxy are coming here now. So basically, yeah, they are like immigrants from the inner or the outer galaxy, and they bring you like different metallicities in building up these wings. And again, similar sort of plot. Here you have ages from isochrones, and you see that you have typical, this is again the alpha over iron measurements, and here is the metallicity. And you see what is called thick disk star, and these are thin disk stars that have different age distributions. And you see that the thick disk component, which is this other component in the galactic disk, is half enhanced, extend up to supersolar metallicities. And this, for example, is very important for constraining formation theories, and is, again, a very hot topic at the moment. And similarly, for the gradients in the galaxy, which is what you need from the distances. So, well, I just skip to the conclusion, saying that that is what has been possible until now for solar neighborhood stars. But with Kepler data, we're going to have like same or better constraints in terms of we're going to derive the stellar parameters, but we're going to be complemented by the astroseismic information. And that's really going to be a great leap forward for that. So just summarizing, the photometry has a lot of information. We talked about effective temperature, how those in the Kepler input catalog are underestimated. We have been addressing about the problem of reddening and how to deal with that. And finally, the future, which is, I know that most of you are just interested in, not just, but interested in the properties of the stars, but I think that is really exciting that, you know, from properties of the stars, a naturally extension of that is just understanding properties of the galaxy. So, thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for this tour de force, and also for making the connection to other fields of astronomy, which is very important, really. So questions, comments? Yeah?
Hi, Luca. You said you could get distances by using the angular diameter from infrared flux method and the radius from seismology, which I agree. But isn't that just the same as saying, from seismology, we can get the luminosity from the scaling relation.
Yes.
And from the luminosity in a bolometric correction, we can get the distance. There's no fundamental difference between those.
No, methods. I mean, the underlying idea is the same. It's the same. The thing is that in this case, you recover the effective temperature and the bolometric luminosity at the same time. So it's sort of, you know, self-consistent. Whereas usually if you take like bolometric correction from literature, you get into all those like zero-point things, et cetera, et cetera. But in this case, you know, we checked with angular diameters that the effective temperature and the bolometric flux give consistent angular diameters compared to interferometry.
Right.
So it's like, I mean, the underlying idea is the same. I think in this case, you have better control on what's going on. But yeah, in principle, the other approach is equally good. Yeah.
Connie?
Why didn't you include BNA stars? And what's your biggest stumbling block?
Okay. I've been mostly working on like later type stars, so that's entirely my fault. The technique as it regards the infrared flux method, for example, for determining temperatures from the photometry, it works as well for hotter stars. Actually, I mean, for hotter stars, basically, the infrared moves even to shorter wavelengths. So, you know, you can start using, like, typically optical almost colors to already work in the Planck tail. But yeah, I mean, it can be extended to hotter temperatures. It's absolutely feasible. Yes.
Do.
Yeah. Oh, it will be extended to hotter temperatures. Yeah. So even better. Right?
Yeah. Mark.
Really nice work, Luca. I think there's two sort of a comment and a question on the hot stars. I think you might have problems with correcting for the UV flux from the infrared flux method. That may actually be significant. And also the fact that they rotate rapidly means a uniform surface temperature may not be a good model. So I'd be little bit worried about the IRFM physically for the hot stars for those reasons.
Yeah, you're right.
And as far as one question is that there's published calibrations for dwarfs, but for the revisions you've done, which are lovely for the but the giants have not yet done. You have a comment on whether we can see an update of the IRFM for giants soon?
Yes.
Because we just did a theoretical extrapolation
paper. I mean, it's coming along. So basically, as I said, the main ingredient in revising the temperature scale was the absolute calibration. And that is pretty much a zero-point offset. So that makes those temperatures hotter compared, say, for example, to Alonso. And so that still stands also for the giants. So I did a few giants, didn't publish, but for people that were interested, and you see the same sort of offset. And we are, yes, we are working on that. The problem is that for many giants, there is not that much available photometry for giants, especially in the infrared, because they're so bright and too much is saturated. So we are working in extending the sample, and we are taking photometry to have a large calibrating sample of stars, which is also important when you build color temperature calibration, because then if you have, you know, like enough stars, then you sample as much as you can the morphology of the calibration. Otherwise, as you also pointed out, you know, if you miss some stars at the extreme, then your calibration there is less constrained, and you know it might just go ways off from the real temperature scale. Because thanks.
So any further questions, comments? Well, in that case, let's thank you
again. Thanks.
And then take a huge jump from the observations to the microphysics. We're going from the macro stuff and down into the what we're here to learn about. And the first talk on that is by Werner Deppen, who is going to talk about microphysics instead of interiors.
If it works.